The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, we have a new feature up at the trumpet.com, Trumpet Talk. You can see it, at least last I checked, about an hour ago. It was at the top of the home page, a chat between Brad McDonald and Richard Palmer to analysts that you hear often on the radio. You'll hear them on Trumpet Hour or filling in for me. But earlier this week, they were able to sit down in front of the television cameras, both of them looking as handsome as ever, to discuss Scotland's referendum and the end of Britain, as it's titled there. It's, I think, a five-minute video. I'd encourage you to go over and to see it and to send in some feedback so that we can let them know how well that they did. I think another thing that this highlights, by the way, is the website card, as we call it. The new features that we post, all of them have one or two older features underneath. Now, the older ones underneath this time are just from a couple of days ago, so they're not from years and years ago, but some have been. And it's just a great way, these cards, to post something that's brand new and to put it together with other items that cover the same subject. And together, I mean, these three pieces, in the case of this particular subject, Scotland's referendum, I mean, you get the full story. You get an article written by Richard Palmer. You have a discussion between him and Brad McDonald. And then I think they also linked to the radio program that we did yesterday. So in one stop, you can get all that you need to know, and then some. Go and see that new piece today at thetrumpet.com. The new and improved trumpet.com. And by the way, we've had over 200 people subscribe to the Trumpet newsletter. We're still working on the alert or the news brief. And hope to get that going even today, expanding upon the Trumpet Weekly that we traditionally have sent out every Friday afternoon. But over the course of these past 6 days, those of you that have gone to the new site, you've probably seen the banner there at the top that asks visitors if they want to sign up for the newsletter. And we've had more than 200 people in about 6 days that have done that. So that's encouraging to see those numbers on the increase. Well, I'd like to begin with another piece that we highlight at the top of the trumpet.com, or at least we did yesterday. This is Peter App's opinion piece at Reuters, titled "Europe on Knife Edge of Uncertainty, Maybe Catastrophe," he says. And then he does a good job of really running through all of the crises that European leaders are confronting. He says, March 2017 is an uncomfortable time to be a European. Almost wherever you look, traditional certainties are unraveling in the face of a perfect storm of crises. I mean, really, this is broader than just Europe even. But you know how significant this is with respect to Europe, because we're all just waiting for the Daniel 8 man to appear. And he even gets into the weak leadership toward the end of his article. It's amazing, really. The pressure that Europe is under, and we know how it's going to come through that pressure. It's going to look a fair bit different than what it looks right now. And it's going to have a strong man, just like Russia has a strong man. Just like China has a strong man. Japan, you can go right down the list. Iran. We're waiting, though, for the strong man to appear in Europe. This article talks about the Brexit, Britain triggering Article 50, and so now it's on the road out of the European Union. It mentions the possibility of another referendum in Scotland. Talks about the populist wave in Europe, the rise of the far right, the AfD being the most popular party or gaining the most popularity, that is. And, of course, Germany has its national elections in September. Yesterday, they had elections in the Netherlands. And, of course, all the media is reporting that Geert Wilders was defeated. And yet here his party has they've gained the largest number of seats ever for that particular party, the PVV party. The New York Times says this morning, this year's election may give the Netherlands its most fragmented government in history. So Wilders did gain. His party did gain, but it was split across all these different parties. I didn't get the exact count. I think there were 9 or 10 of them. And so it's another example of a fragmented government. It says some political analysts believe it could take weeks or months to form a government. And in that, the governing coalition will be fragile. I think the most seats obtained by the People's Party for Freedom and Democracy, they got 32 seats out of, a possible 150. And then Mr. Wilders, he brought in 19 for the Christian Democratic Appeal. And I believe Richard Palmer was telling me this morning that it's going to take 4 of the parties to come together to form a government. This New York Times piece says in Belgium, which has a similar political system as the Netherlands, it famously took nearly a year and a half after inconclusive elections in June 2010 to form a government. So more instability. More, even with the rise of Geert Wilders, and he was pretty optimistic about the results yesterday because, as I say, for his party, it was pretty good. They won't tell you that in the mainstream media, however. They're cheering because, well, the populist wave took a hit. The populist wave is gaining momentum. It's gaining momentum. We're only 2 or 3 years away from the time when these groups like the AfD were getting 2 or 3% of the vote. Now it's up to 20 or 25. Now Geert Wilders' party has 19 seats. Uncertainty. Uncertainty. And what is it leading to? What if it takes a long time for the Netherlands to form a government? Well, you just add it to the list that this opinion piece at Reuters brings out. Europe on knife edge of uncertainty. It talks about an aggressive Russia moving into Europe's eastern flank. And because of this, Sweden's having to reintroduce conscription. That's something that Sweden abolished in 2010. Now they're bringing it back. They've got to respond to Russia. So does Finland. Finland's conducting all these military exercises. They've got to push back against Russia. Look at the Baltic states. NATO's deployed its largest force there since the Cold War. One after another after another. What is it building toward? This Reuters opinion piece, it says, nor has the crisis for the European single currency gone away. Indeed, having struggled along ever since the financial crisis of 2008, it may be entering a new and volatile stage. The Italian election, I mean, that could happen in a few months. And the side that wants out of the currency block, it's gaining in popularity as well. Uncertainty. Crisis. It says here at Reuters, Europe may not be unraveling, but it does seem in a state of semi-permanent crisis. For almost a decade, European crisis summits, in which leaders convene over a weekend to talk over issues such as the single currency or EU reform, have been the norm, and few have produced particularly incisive results. I mean, they've had all the meetings. They've had all the summits, but they haven't brought about any lasting change or positive change. They haven't put forward any solutions to these many crises. And it says here, listen to this, much seems a matter of leadership. This is Peter Apps at Reuters. They're missing leadership at both a national and regional level. Europe's leaders appear to be suffering a crisis of confidence, popularity, and at worst, political legitimacy. Again, you can see it in the Dutch elections yesterday. All these differing parties, all these competing factions. And now you enter into another period of uncertainty with respect to the Netherlands and its government. But like Peter Apps writes at Reuters, it seems like the problem here is leadership, whether it's the national level or the regional level or all across Europe. Europe's leaders, they don't have the confidence. They don't have the popular support. That's coming. Don't you know that's coming? Daniel chapter 8, chapter 11. A smooth operator. He's in the background right now, but he's about to come to the foreground. He's about to step forward. As it is right now, I mean, it's uncertain. There's lots of division. It's iron and clay. And Vladimir Putin, as this article brings out, he's over there to the east and doing everything he can to exploit this period of instability. Some analysts have said that that's one reason he was so keen on intervening in Syria. Because he knew the humanitarian disaster to follow would flood Europe with refugees. He's exploiting this instability in Europe. Peter Apps says that the events in the United States have added to this period of uncertainty for Europe. The rest of the world's not helping either. He talks about the division, the recent spat between the Turkish government and the Dutch government. The Turkish government accusing the Dutch of being run by a Nazi regime, of all things. And then the terrorist attacks. Brussels, Nice, Berlin, elsewhere. It's fueling this division, the article says. Right now, Peter Apps writes, Europe's institutions have a distinct smell of collapse around them, but their resilience, so far at least, remains striking. The various European projects now under pressure, the EU, NATO, the single currency, even the basic political institutions and establishments that administer each country are imperfect. But they've also delivered some remarkable results, not least keeping the peace on the continent for more than six decades. It's talking about that post-World War II order maintained primarily by NATO. But he says here, it's hard to say where things go from here. While the institutions of European integration offer the best hope, countries can hardly be blamed for taking matters into their own hands when it comes to defending themselves. And it refers to this piece at The Economist last week that's about Germany possibly being willing to break one of its last and greatest taboos. And that's whether or not to build a nuclear weapons program. That's all. That's all that it's about. And it's up to Germany. No one else cares. The United States isn't protesting. Great Britain's not protesting. I mean, they may not be heartily behind it. But still, the Economist piece talks about Germany might be willing to break with one of its greatest taboos, as if it's up to Germany. No problemo, just kick off the nuclear weapons program. And the rest of the world, presumably, is just fine with that. As if World War II didn't happen, or World War I. It says somehow Europe has to convince itself things are not quite as bad as they look and find some optimistic route forward. Otherwise, they might get worse than anyone is willing to contemplate. Well, that's what Peter Apps has to say at Reuters, a left-wing publication, and I presume a left-wing commentator who can see. Look, these are serious crises that are piling up. And as I said earlier, I mean, it's not like it's just limited to the European continent. This uncertainty It's all over the world. Jeremiah Jacques had a piece at the top of the Trumpet earlier today about Japan dispatching its largest warship military force since World War II. Is that significant? I told you the other day about the threat coming from North Korea and how Japan's talking about how that we're going to have to produce more offensive weapons. Never mind the fact that in their constitution coming out of World War II, they weren't allowed to do that. And technically speaking, they're not allowed to do what they're doing right now with this warship. The Izumo, I guess it's pronounced, says Japanese authorities, this is Jeremiah's piece, Japanese authorities said on March 14 that the Japan Maritime Self-Defense Force will dispatch its largest warship, the Izumo helicopter carrier, on a three-month tour through the South China Sea. The move represents Japan's largest show of military force since World War II and marks a major step in Tokyo's march toward remilitarization. So Japan is remilitarizing itself. Germany is talking about building nuclear weapons. Germany is entering into all of these bilateral agreements with its neighbors. These military exercises, these joint ventures with the Netherlands, with France, with the Czech Republic, and on it goes. I mentioned that article yesterday or the day before, talking about how the 2% increase in defense spending, just focusing solely on that, misses the point of what's happening in Germany. Just in the last year or two, with respect to a unified military force in Europe and the changing mood and attitude in Germany with respect to a military force. And here's Japan marching toward remilitarization. And the world, I suppose, hits the snooze button. China claims, this is Jeremiah's article, China claims nearly all of the vast resource-rich South China Sea, through which one-third of the world's maritime trade passes, Brunei, Malaysia, Philippines, Taiwan, and Vietnam, also claim portions of the sea. It talks about here the island building, all these bases that China's building in the South China Sea, and just the threat that that poses to all the neighbors of China and to all of this trade. A third of the world's maritime trade. It goes right through this region that's now controlled and dominated by China. Jeremiah says Japan has no claims to the South China Sea, but it is entangled in separate territorial disputes with China over parts of the East China Sea. And so off goes Izumo, this battleship, its largest warship. It's the largest show of military force since the end of World War II, this helicopter carrier. The Izumo, it says, can carry up to 400 Marines and 14 attack helicopters. It's scheduled to sail from Japan in May, and it gives all the stopping points along the way. Zero Hedge said that Japan dispatching the warship means the tension over the disputed territory in the South China Sea is about to escalate to another level. Here again, a world primed for conflict. Well, this takes the South China Sea controversy or conflict, or division. This takes it all up to another level. But now listen to this history. Here again, this is important history. We have to keep going back to it, just like we do with respect to Germany. It's only been 70 years. In the past century, Germany has started two world wars. With respect to Japan, Jeremiah says here, at the end of World War II, U.S.-occupied Japan was given a constitution that outlawed war as a means for Japan to settle international disputes. It was outlawed in Article 9 of the Constitution. Now, with respect to Germany again, think of the joint statement released by America and Britain, released by Churchill and Roosevelt. We are going to prevent Germany from ever, ever remilitarizing. We're going to take care of the general staff. We're going to take care of all the companies that that produce armaments. It's all over. It's never, ever, ever again going to be able to disturb the peace of the world. 70 years ago. And then the Japanese Constitution, Article 9. The Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat or use of force as means of settling international disputes. This is the Japanese Constitution. Land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained. Never, it used the word never. Now, you can, again, immediately think of what Japanese officials would say, just like I quoted to you yesterday, with the threat of North Korea and the United States not as firmly supportive of its allies in the South Pacific like it used to be, or in Southeast Asia, I mean. And so Japan's saying, look, if there's all these threats from China, from North Korea, from wherever else, we've got to build up our military. We have no choice. Same thing in Europe. Well, if NATO, if Mr. Trump's going in the other direction, if he's not enthusiastically supporting NATO's operations, then we have no other choice. We've got Putin breathing down our neck. A world primed for conflict. You talk about a period of instability and uncertainty. It's a world on the knife edge of uncertainty, not just Europe. And all of these developments converging, well, together, right at the same time. Here it's illegal for Japan to have all of this war potential. Jeremiah says here, that constitution has governed Japan in the 70 years since the end of World War II. He says, but Japanese leaders have quietly moved away from pacifism and toward remilitarization, especially under the current prime minister, Shinzo Abe. It says, dispatching the Izumo represents the latest and one of the boldest moves away from Article 9 and toward an assertive military. And so Japan moves further away from Article 9. Germany moves further away from the strictures put upon it in the joint statement in 1945. And the world barely notices. I mean, the world sees the hot spots. The world sees all the conflict. The world sees the uncertainty, the political division, the strife, the refugee problems. And here we are about to repeat history from the World War II era. History from the World War I era, the war that was supposed to end all wars. And then came the Second World War, another one that should have ended all wars, but it didn't. And why? Well, that takes us to the problem with man ruling over man, the problem of human nature. Human nature is the cause of these conflicts, these never-ending conflicts, these intensifying conflicts and divisions. Human nature is to blame. You see it now in just about every development, whether it's an election in the Netherlands or ethnic divisions in the Middle East. Division. Division and strife. The United Nations, division. The United States, division. The media and President Trump. We'll get into that in the next segment. Division. Division even within specific political parties. Division on the streets of America. Culturally, ethnically, according to political class, cultural class, whatever. It's even celebrated, that division, in Western nations. And yet, as the Bible says, What happens to a house divided? It's not going to be able to stand for much longer. It's building, isn't it? It's building to worldwide conflict. That's what Jesus prophesied. Let's just look at that here before we head to a break. This is a passage that you're very familiar with, Matthew. You go right to the Gospels to see the truth. This is a prophecy. This came from the mouth of Jesus Christ. A lot of traditional Christians, they like to talk about Christ. They like to talk about peace and love. And that is coming. And Christ was filled with love. Here's what the loving Jesus Christ had to say about the end time. He said, "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of this world, to this time, no, nor ever shall be." It's the worst ever. And look, the Bible is consistent. If it says this kind of thing in Matthew 24:21 and Jeremiah 30:7 and Daniel 12:1, the worst ever, then, I mean, it's all talking about the same thing. This same climactic period, right at the end of the days, right at the end of the age of man, culminating in the return of Jesus Christ. Jesus said, "And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened." God's going to cut it short. Otherwise, look what would happen. Look what we'd do to ourselves. Well, you read just a few verses later. "For as lightning comes out of the east and shines even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." Jesus Christ's return. They'll see him. It says, they'll see the Son of Man, verse 30, coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. All will see this blessed event. You could look further over at Revelation 1 and verse 7. And then all the other prophecies, the next verse talks about him coming at the sound of a trumpet, the seventh trumpet blast, 1 Thessalonians 4, 1 Corinthians 15. That's the truth of the Bible. That's the hope. That's the only hope. Imagine, though, putting your hope in one of these organizations, NATO or the EU or an alliance in East Asia. A world prime for conflict, but it's leading right into the wonderful world tomorrow. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
You believe there's any evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia?
There is the suggestion out there from an awful lot of Trump critics that those dots may well connect in some way that points to collusion.
Of alleged collusion between Donald Trump and Russia.
A dossier bluntly asserts that there was collusion.
Allegations of Russian collusion.
The allegations of collusion with Russia.
Or that there was some greater potential collusion.
And lying about collusion.
Criminality or collusion.
Now, I'm not even at the direct collusion stage yet.
I'm not saying that there was necessarily collusion.
Possible. Collusion.
Whether there was collusion.
Collusion with the Russians.
And any collusion, alleged collusion.
And this question of collusion.
Is there any evidence of collusion?
Any evidence of any connections between the Trump campaign collusion?
Well, we don't know it.
But Congressman, you said that the collusion, there's no evidence that there's collusion.
They didn't find any evidence of collusion.
We have no evidence of collusion.
There is no evidence of collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign.
And when it comes to the issue of collusion, which was the word that was used today, you know, it depends what, you know, how direct you're talking.
But at this point, what's not proven is the idea of collusion.
That's correct.
Well, we at least know what the word for the year has been in the major media. Collusion. There was collusion. Now there's not collusion. We don't know if there was collusion. There might have been collusion. That was put together by Washington Free Beacon. We had a program a couple of weeks ago. About the media, as you know, hyping this story, the collusion, and the fact that the Trump administration for months was being investigated. And the New York Times and the Washington Post and all these other groups in the major media, they were quite proud of the fact that they were revealing the details of all of this wiretapping, of all of these investigations, headed up by the White House itself under President Obama. And then, as I said a couple of weeks ago, you had some, like Mark Levin, come forward and say, well, hang on a second. I mean, what kind of tactics are these? This is like a police state. To just be tapping into everyone's phones, anyone that's associated with candidate Trump. And then the media flipped out, and it was made worse by a tweet put out by President Trump. Who said he was being wiretapped. And so now all the focus is on that. And the fact that now there was no wiretapping. Now there really wasn't much of an investigation. And now we know that there wasn't collusion. This is a piece by Eli Lake. It's at Bloomberg, posted just yesterday. The title is that Trump's wiretap claims are bogus, but he's still on to something. Some interesting points brought out by Mr. Lake here in this article. It says, on Wednesday, Representative Devin Nunes and the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Panel and that body's ranking Democrat, Adam Schiff, announced that they were seeking information on how the identities of American citizens picked up in eavesdropping on foreign targets were unmasked in more widely disseminated intelligence reports. So how did this happen with General Flynn and other incidents where private communications were made public? What government agencies had access to this information? And so there's an investigation into this, even as the major media still is obsessed over the tweet and trying to show that President Trump lied or whatever else. But as Eli Lake brings out here, he seems like he's onto something based upon what Representative Nunes in particular is saying. I mean, he's the chairman of the House Intelligence Panel, and they're investigating this. Eli Lake says this is important because of the case of Michael Flynn, Trump's first national security advisor. He resigned after the Washington Post reported on his conversations with the Russian ambassador to the U.S., conversations that took place after Trump's victory, but before his swearing in. At the time, the story was about how Flynn had not come clean about an element of those conversations, touching on sanctions just imposed on Russia. But another big part of that story is how the intercepted communications of an incoming national security advisor found its way into the newspaper. How did it find its way into the Washington Post? I think that's what Mark Levin was sounding the alarm on. And now some in Congress are picking that up and running with it, as well they should. It says earlier this month, Obama's last national director of national intelligence, James Clapper, said there were no Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrants that he knew of targeting Trump or his campaign. This surely means that Flynn was caught on a wiretap of the Russian ambassador. Normally, the names of Americans incidentally collected, to use the intelligence community's phrase, are redacted from reports that are sent out to senior government officials. Was Flynn's name redacted in this case? If not, were summaries or transcripts of his conversation widely distributed within the government? That would have made it much easier to leak. I mean, if all these agencies were well aware of this conversation. But as Eli Lake is bringing out, why wasn't Mr. Flynn redacted from these exchanges? And maybe the agencies would say, well, we had good reason to reveal it. But really, what was revealed in those communications? Nothing illegal. But now when you look at unmasking someone, an American citizen, well, that's something that needs to be considered as well. I mentioned these two, Adam Schiff, the Democrat, and then Devin Nunes. These are the two leading up the investigation brought on by the House Intelligence Panel. They had a press conference yesterday. Here's clip two from that conference.
I don't think there was an actual tap of Trump Tower. However, as I expressed last week, and I remain even more concerned about this, which are twofold. One, the incidental collection of Americans that were possibly tied to the Trump campaign that could have been leaked, similar to General Flynn. And secondly, the unmasking of Americans' names, potentially for political purposes, which we're continuing to ask more about that. Mr. Schiff and I are sending a letter today to Director Comey, Pompeo, and Admiral Rogers, asking for the total number of names that were unmasked over the course of the last 6 months.
They're going back as far as 6 months ago. That's what he's concerned about. Now, the Democrat's not quite as concerned about that. He's concerned about the tweet. And everybody in the media is on board with that. We've got to show how that President Trump is lying or exaggerating. Well, I don't even know if they'd say that. It's just an outright lie, they say. That they're all in agreement on it. But what about this incidental collection? What? And think, as I go through this, you think about America Under Attack, and it also in Great Again, both of those booklets, and the past 8 years, and all that was going on. Leave aside Donald Trump. I'll get to some examples here in just a second. But that's why this story is worth getting into, even though it's in some ways in the past and the Obama administration is no longer there. But it just proves what we wrote in America Under Attack years ago and what the media universally was ignoring, totally ignoring. Eli Lake says here, that's what Nunes and Schiff want to know. In a March 15 letter to the heads of CIA, FBI, and the National Security Agency, they asked for for the total number of times a U.S. person's identity was unmasked between June 2016 and January 2017. They also want to know the names of any U.S. persons unmasked in incidental collection who were affiliated or part of the Trump or Hillary Clinton campaigns in the same period, and who inside the executive branch asked for these names to be unmasked. Who is it? I mean, the New York Times was saying just a few months ago that this went all the way up, or just a month ago, I should say. It went all the way up to the White House before President Trump was inaugurated. Who was it inside the executive branch? One more clip from the press conference yesterday, number three.
Mr. Nunes, you said pretty clearly that you do not think that Trump Tower was tapped. What gives you that confidence to say
that? Well, I actually said that last week. I think the challenge here is that you know, President Obama wouldn't physically go over and wiretap Trump Tower. So now you have to decide, as I mentioned to you last week, are you going to take the tweets literally? And if you are, then clearly the president was wrong. But if you're not going to take the tweets literally, and if there's a concern that the president has about other people, other surveillance activities, looking at him or his associates, either appropriately or inappropriately, we want to find that out.
We want to find that out. And if you take the gist of the tweet, but certainly if you put down, if you take the argument that Mark Levin put down, you begin to connect the dots. And the fact that the media would rush to the defense of the Obama administration, as if it's entirely impossible for an administration like his to surveil Donald Trump, to surveil the Trump campaign. And that just shows you how far in the tank they were for the one that they practically worshipped. Here again, you think of America Under Attack. I just brought it with me. I think it's the start of chapter two, where it talks about the reporter Michael Hastings talking about how influential President Obama was over reporters. Just the presence of Barack Obama weakened the knees of these reporters. This is in an interview with Martin Bashir. You can see it on page 12 of America Under Attack. Hastings telling Bashir, but that's the presence of Obama, even on the press corps, even on the people who follow him every day. When they're near him, they lose their minds sometimes. They start behaving in ways that are juvenile and amateurish, and they swoon. They swoon over Obama, but certainly not over Donald Trump. And so even after hyping this, wiretaps, investigations, collusion, 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 then someone turns on the press and says, hang on a second. Okay, if all of this is true, then who was behind it, the investigations? Well, that actually didn't happen. And now that you mention it, we've looked into it, and there wasn't collusion. Eli Lake says this, in Flynn's case, there may be sound reasons why his name was not redacted. Well, and he goes on to quote a security expert that says, you know, in what cases are these incidental contacts? In what cases would they be redacted? Most likely they should be redacted, or in most cases they should be redacted. If it's something more serious, threatening national security, then they can be revealed. But as this expert brought out in the exchange with Eli Lake, sometimes it's just in the eye of the beholder. Something that might seem innocent on its face might appear more nefarious from the perspective of someone who views the incoming team's policies with skepticism. And so you go back to that, what was it, the March 1 New York Times piece, where they said that the Obama administration wanted to leave a trail before leaving office to make sure all these intelligence agencies knew that there was, in fact, something nefarious. Eli Lake says here, there's already some evidence to suggest Nunez and Schiff are onto something. It says on March 1, the New York Times reported that in the final, well, that's what I just said there. They rushed, it says, to preserve and distribute intelligence on connections between Russia and Trump's associates throughout the government. It says, in practice, this meant that raw intelligence was processed into analytical reports and classified at a relatively low level. And then the New York Times said, this is quoting the New York Times, as Inauguration Day approached, Obama White House officials grew convinced that the intelligence was damning and that they needed to ensure that as many people as possible inside government could see it. They knew, they were convinced it was damning. They knew there was collusion. They knew Russia was involved. Now James Clapper and the others say, no collusion. And Trump's, he's an idiot for suggesting that that we were wiretapping Trump Tower. You can't get the truth. You can't get the truth. Not from the major media. Eli Lake says here, did this raw intelligence include Flynn's calls with the Russian ambassador? Depending on what Schiff and Nunez turn up, this could be a real scandal, particularly if the names of other Trump associates picked up in incidental surveillance were unmasked and distributed widely within the government. This would mean that the Obama administration had effectively short-circuited the FISA process. Okay, so maybe they didn't apply for a FISA request. They may have just gone right around it. It says, by checking to see if Trump associates were picked up incidentally on existing surveillance and then disseminating the take widely within the intelligence bureaucracy, he concludes here, that's not the same as ordering, without court or oversight, a targeted wiretap on Trump Tower, but it's pretty serious nonetheless. It may not be the same as ordering a wiretap on Trump Tower, but short-circuiting the FISA process to spy on Trump associates using existing surveillance and then disseminating it widely, as the New York Times reported on March 1st, to leave a trail for these intelligence operations. The media are so obsessed over President Trump's tweet because they have to protect their own. They have to protect Barack Obama. Here again, go back and review America Under Attack and some of the things that my father has to say there, particularly about the lies. He sets up the booklet by talking about Satan's influence, about Satan's attack on the United States of America, how that Satan comes as an angel of light. And how that the devil was cast down in 1986. And that you can detect this evil spiritual influence in the world today. In Great Again, my father said this, when he became president, Barack Obama promised his supporters a radical transformation of the U.S., Mr. Obama is an outspoken critic of the Constitution and long desired to cast off its restraints. And then he made no secret about his enthusiastic support for Hillary Clinton. I mean, that was a continuation of his legacy. She was supposed to be voted in. She was supposed to carry on the torch. And then his world was rocked on November 8th when Donald Trump won. And you have this onslaught of reports coming from the liberal leftist media. I think the Russians tampered with this. Tucker Carlson, by the way, I think his report was last night. He talked about the NBC News sitting on that Access Hollywood tape for 11 years. That was owned by NBC. And it certainly revealed a dark side to Mr. Trump. And he was rightly criticized for what he said on those tapes. But you want to talk about collusion? Here, right, just days before the election, NBC, holding on to this tape, well aware that releasing it, I mean, given the wiretap laws in the United States, it might put them in danger of a lawsuit. They released the tape because their hatred and animosity toward Donald Trump, it was so intense, and the race was close enough. They had to do it to try to bring Donald Trump down. That's a news organization doing that. You want to talk about influencing elections? Forget about the Russians for a second. Look at the major media. Look at what's happened. In every political cycle, every campaign cycle, from the last election to the one before that, to the one before that, and on and on and on it goes. It's an attack. It's pretty amazing. exchange there between Michael Hastings and Martin Bashir. Recorded there in the first bit of chapter two. In America, under attack. David Zurawiec, he had a column at the Baltimore Sun last week. Trump's war on the press, no match for Obama's. He says, in fairness, this is a liberal who at least has a shred of honesty. He says, in fairness to Trump, his administration has not escalated the conflict with the press to a new level. The piece is about how all of these journalists saying, this is unprecedented, what Donald Trump has done, I mean, to keep us from the gaggle. It's unprecedented. A president has never done this. And here's one who has the honesty to at least say, now look, I don't agree with it, but it's not unprecedented. He says it has not yet come close to doing what President Obama's administration did in making the act of reporting itself criminal behavior in a case that started in 2009. This was the first year of the Obama administration. It was started under the Espionage Act of 1917. That's what the Obama administration used to go after a reporter by the name of James Rosen. At the heart of the case is James Rosen, chief Washington correspondent for Fox News, publishing information about North Korea that he received from a State Department employee. In obtaining a subpoena to access Rosen's phone and computer records, the Justice Department labeled him, James Rosen, an aider, abettor, and or co-conspirator. It also described him as a flight risk. David Zurawiec says here, branding a reporter that way in court documents had never been done by the government. I mean, you want to talk about unprecedented? Read chapter one of Great Again. Branding a reporter that way in court documents had never been done by the government. It says, since the case was widely reported, I'm surprised an act that really was unprecedented was overlooked by so many pundits in making their worst ever analysis. He gives another example. James Rosen and then James Risen of the New York Times. It says here, the Obama Justice Department spent 7 years in court trying to force Risen to reveal his sources in its criminal investigation of a leak. They went after these reporters. I mean, they actually hauled them off into court and would have sent them to jail were it not for the courts stopping it. It says Team Obama took the case all the way to the Supreme Court. For 7 years, Zurawiec says, for 7 years, James Risen had the threat of jail, had the threat of prison hanging over his head as he fought off Obama's Justice Department. Zurawiec says, Risen, a Pulitzer Prize winner, doesn't need me to make his case. Read his Times article published in December of 2016. The title, If Donald Trump Targets Journalists, Thank Obama. Thank Obama. You want to go back to precedent? If Mr. Trump goes after journalists, if he goes after the media, you can thank Barack Obama for that. Now, in Great Again, there's a section, I think it's underneath the section, subhead, Lies, page 11. Page 11 of Great Again by my father. He says, Mr. Obama repeatedly said how transparent his administration would be, yet virtually everything he has done has been in the dark. Many journalists have complained that his has been the most opaque administration in history. I mean, they were complaining at the time. Now they've forgotten all about that. Now Donald Trump, He's the one that's, well, he's unprecedented. We've never had anything like this, except for a year ago, except for 2-3 years ago, except for 6-7 years ago. It says here, that is the path to a violent dictator ruling America. Again, you go back to Levin's statement from a couple weeks ago, police state tactics. And Great Again, my father talked about it being a violent dictator. He refers to a testimony in 2013, James Clapper again, where he was asked, does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? I think we played this clip on this program. Clapper said, no, sir, not wittingly. Well, we don't do it wittingly. All these wiretaps, all of this information collected on data, telephone communications, and on it goes. I mean, that's what the last administration was known for. My father says, as these scandals pile higher and higher, nobody can get administration officials to tell them anything. They've lied and lied and lied and have been caught in their lies. This administration covers itself in a cloak of deceit. In some cases, they've even joked or bragged about their lies. Think about Ben Rhodes and what we covered last year with respect to that Iran nuke deal. Just bragging about deceiving the press. I mean, just playing with the press like a cat plays with an injured mouse. That's what the previous administration was doing for 8 years. And even worse than playing, going after some of them, targeting some of them, targeting the Associated Press, targeting James Rosen, targeting James Risen. And now, just a couple months into a new administration and one that the media just absolutely despises, all of that history, recent history, quickly forgotten. And what we're going through now is, oh, it's unprecedented. Well, I've got more here in my notes. I just looked at the clock. I'm out of time. That's as far as I can go on this particular program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email the program, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.